Good morning, counsel. You may approach and you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jovan Loster. I am the attorney for the appellants, which is the estate of Marlene Benesch. I'm here this morning with Karen Mohotch. Karen is the personal representative of the estate of Marlene Benesch. She is also one of six daughters, which were the heirs of the estate of Marlene Benesch. The other five heirs are listening online very attentively this morning. I would ask that 2 minutes be reserved for rebuttal, please. I'd like to start just very briefly on the general nature of the case so you understand what got us to where we are. This case involves the six sisters that I referred to previously who inherited 14.84% of stock ownership in a family farming corporation that consisted of both family farming land as well as an implement dealership. That is what they inherited from their mother, Marlene Benesch, who passed away in the fall of 2017. In order for us to probate the estate of Marlene, Karen Mohotch, who also is a paralegal, began investigating the issue of value with respect to that stock ownership for purposes of inheritance tax determination, federal state tax returns, and the common processes. That investigation resulted in various inquiries regarding assets, values, and liabilities related to that corporation. Those inquiries resulted then in a number of very concerning things to Karen Mohotch and to our office. Those things including the fact that as part of the valuation request, there was a complete absence of any chemical and parts inventories for the implement dealership. Now we know after a trial on the merits, there were millions of dollars of those assets, those things involving concerns with respect to the four brothers self-dealing by farming personally, land that was owned by the corporation for less than fair market rents, for using equipment without any compensation, for grain receipts that simply weren't matching up after investigation.
Where was this information brought to us in our record?
This would be in the testimony of Karen Benesch. I believe it's actually pages, bill of exception, pages 75 through 81 is where Karen testifies to that. Understanding in the context of what we're dealing with is a judicial dissolution. That is a secondary issue, of course, right? The reason we're going through a judicial dissolution action, which then is converted to a fair value determination, is because the brothers, through the corporation, elected to purchase those shares rather than to object and to resist the application for a judicial dissolution.
That would have been relevant to the expenses determination.
Yes, exactly. The one, arguably the two areas where it is relevant is with respect to the determination of expense, because that requires a showing of probable grounds for relief under the statute, as well as to the interest component, because the interest component requires the installment for the judge to grant installments, there has to be a showing of some sort of necessity and equity in that case.
Let's talk about the expenses real quick.
Yeah.
Pursuant to 21-2,201, imposition expenses is discretionary, correct, for the trial court?
That is correct.
And that's reviewed on abuse of that discretion?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Can you tell us what your best argument is that the court abuses discretion?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Two things are concerning to us. One is the lack of clarity in the statute. The former statute under the Nebraska Business Corporation Act specifically spelled out the recovery of attorney fees and expense costs, expert costs and the like. This statute, as modified under the Model Business Corporation Act, indicates simply the term expenses. So there's an ambiguity, I think, in the statute as to what's intended there. I think the judge, rather than take up that question of whether attorney fees are or aren't recoverable under the terms expenses, indicated there was not probable grounds for relief. It is our position, based on the testimony I just described to you, pages 75 through 81, Karen's testimony in the record, that there was a arguably mountain of evidence that supported that there were probable grounds for release. There were various harassing comments that were made to Karen specifically from the brothers, most notably from Chris Benesch, who had specifically threatened her on a couple of occasions, had argued that the corporation didn't have any value. All of this predating any filing of the request for judicial dissolution. The request by the sisters to be named directors or officers of the corporation, and a complete unwillingness of the brothers to allow them to serve in that capacity, and unwillingness to allow them to sit in on directors' meetings, things that simply culminated in the probable grounds for relief and the necessity of the filing for judicial dissolution.
Now, just real quickly touching on the attorney's fees, the predecessor in the statutory scheme That's 21-20,166. That was the statute that was repealed and essentially replaced by 21-2,201. The predecessor actually listed attorney fees, and the subsequent statute did not. Why wouldn't we just assume the legislature knew what they were doing there and remove that remedy?
And certainly that would be within the court's discretion. I think that the court has the right under de novo review to interpret the statute as the court deems appropriate and what the intent of the statute would be. If certainly this court believes that the intent was to forego the right of someone who is an oppressed shareholder to be able to recover attorney fees and costs when they feel compelled to bring these actions, and that somehow, even though it wasn't expressly stated, that was the intent, you have the right to make that statutory interpretation.
I beg your pardon, sir. So this change in the statute, roughly comparable, but not quite. What we now have, is this correct? Is a uniform statute? And if so, what have other state courts said about the absence of attorney fees?
Yes, Your Honor, and that brings up a good point I wanted to make. There's a recent holding that I think is very instructive in this case. It's an Iowa holding that was just from a couple months ago. That particular case, I'm going to butcher the name, was Gauge, G-U-G-E versus Castle Enterprises. The case citation was 2021 Westlaw 248-3399. And in that particular case, it took up a conflict similar to this, where it's a family farming corporation, and it addressed all of the issues, including the issue of expenses. And in Iowa, at least in that case, they determined that attorney fees and costs were recoverable. They didn't go through, I would say, a detailed analysis of what the legislative intent in Iowa was with respect to that change or any kind of a detailed discussion, but rather simply awarded attorney fees and expenses.
Do the comments to the Model Business Corporation Act shed any light on the expense question, what that includes?
I don't know, quite candidly, Your Honor. I think the two comments that have been raised by appellee in this case relate to the discounting issue, comment one and comment four. I'm not sure that I can recall a comment within the Model Business Corporation that specifically speaks to what is intended under the Model Act by the term expenses. I do think they're similar to the Iowa case. There are a number of cases since 2016 when that act was enacted that have awarded attorney fees and expenses. But I don't know that Nebraska has addressed the issue. And I think appellee's reliance is on the general proposition that case authority says that if it doesn't specifically state it, it's not allowed.
You've also assigned error with respect to the discounts. I see your time is dwindling away. Do you want to touch on
that? Yeah, very quickly, Your Honor. That's our primary argument in this case. That's the biggest concerning thing. That reduced the value of the corporation by $8 million, our interest in the corporation by $1.23 million. Basically, our position is law in Nebraska started with Rigel in 1994. Rigel indicated from a policy perspective why individuals in these instances shouldn't have discounts applied to them and how that's inequitable. There was a long absence of any real case authority until we got to the ANR Ag Spraying case, which was determined by this court last year. In that case, it said look to, for purposes of determining what fair value is in judicial dissolution, look to the appraisal rights statute, which specifically defines fair value under the Model Business Act. I think that opened the door, but discounts weren't addressed in that case. Then, unfortunately, after this court makes the decision, we get the Wayne Ryan case that was decided earlier this year by this court, which within that case on the trial court granted summary judgment on the issue of discounts and said, no, under Rigel, Nebraska doesn't allow for discounting for marketability or minority discounts, and it's plainly not allowed. So our position basically is look at Rigel, A&R Ag Spraying, look at the Wayne Ryan case, look at the definition of fair value under the Model Business Act and the appraisal rights statute, which the very next section that you guys looked at under the A&R Ag Spraying case specifically says discounts are not allowed, Your Honor.
Even though the Chief Justice isn't here, we typically ask that you not refer to the court as you guys.
Oh, excuse me. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Okay. What about the comments to the Model Business Corporation Act? I understand your argument based on the case law, but does the appellee have a an argument you need to respond to on the comments?
Well, I think certainly the comments are something the court necessarily would take into consideration. I would say those, again, are comments to the Model Business Corporation, not Nebraska statute. And those are the same comments then that Iowa in the Google case that I just expressed, as well as if you read through my brief, the predominant and overwhelming theory and under state law is that discounting is not allowed. And that the overwhelming majority of cases indicated that. The handful of cases cited by appellee, which indicates that some cases have allowed for either minority or marketability discounts. A number of those, like Connecticut, Washington, and the like, actually have since the new act was enacted, taken a contrary position and refused to apply discounts. And so certainly that those comments exist. I'm not denying that they do. But the way most states have viewed them, the way that the trial court in the Wayne Ryan case viewed them, is that they weren't instructive on this particular issue from either a public policy standpoint, or certainly in our case, because we have a specific definition of fair value under the Nebraska Model Business Corporation Act.
You would concede that the statute for appraisal rights that says don't apply discounts, that statute by its terms doesn't directly apply to the buyout and the dissolution context.
It is in a different section of Chapter 21 of the Nebraska Revised Statute. However, again, I think just last year in the A&R Ag Spraying case, the court said we are going to look at that definition of fair value as being instructive for purposes of judicial dissolution. It just stopped short of saying we're also going to look at the next section because the issue wasn't obviously part of that proceeding.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. How much time did we take counsel, or did counsel go over?
1 minute, 20 seconds.
We'll add that then to the appellee's time. And we'll wait briefly while the clock is adjusted. Very well, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel Sheila Benson of Rumble Ludke, representing appellee and cross appellant Benish Service Company. I'll start where we left off, which I agree is the most significant legal in this issue in this case, which is whether or not the application of minority and marketability discounts are appropriate under certain circumstances and judicial dissolution.
As we go into that, I believe that one of the issues we need to address is the definition of fair value.
Absolutely.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it appears that the court used a definition out of 21-20,166, which actually is a statute that was repealed prior to the beginning of this action. Is that correct?
My understanding is the district court did not adopt a specific definition of fair value at the lower court level. Appellant urged the court to look at the shareholder appraisal statute, which is 21-2,171, and also urged the court to look at this Rigel case, which is a shareholder dissenting appraisal action case, which is an important distinction. And the court acknowledged that appellant was urging that definition, and ultimately the district court said that definition doesn't apply. If the legislature intended for that definition of fair value that says you don't get to have the discounts, legislature would have adopted it. And the court, I think, importantly noted that, I believe it was like 1994, we had this Rigel case decided, shareholder dissenting rights case prior to Model Business Corporation Act. And in that case, the court said in these types of dissenting shareholder cases, it's not appropriate for discounts. After that, the legislature adopted the Model Business Corporation Act, codified that definition, but only in the appraisal act section. It didn't extend that definition into our judicial dissolution section, which I think is a signal to courts that they're not mandating that courts adopt a bright line rule where discounts always are or always are not appropriate.
Where did the fair value definition come from then?
In general, the court, in evaluating, you know, the factors that go into fair value, such as there's not just one way to adopt a valuation, you have to look at factors such as the nature of the business, those types of things. That comes from this court's case law. And the district court quoted this court in Anderson, which does refer to that definition in the appraisal statute. But this court never said this is a exact, we're not pulling it, we're pulling it by analogy. And the courts never spoke to the issue of discounts.
Yeah, counsel, I understand the argument that this is not an appraisal rights case. This is a dissolution case. But aren't the interests of the shareholders, particularly the shareholder who's being bought out, exactly the same in a dissolution case as it would be in an appraisal rights case?
And I would respectfully disagree. I think sometimes they're exactly the same, but sometimes they're not. And I think that's what's a good result from the lower court's approach of what I would consider a flexible approach as opposed to a bright line. And the district court addresses this well in her opinion. And she talks about how this case, this particular case, is not analogous to the dissenting appraisal rights case, because this is a case where the lower court specifically said there is not evidence of shareholder oppression. In fact, the context of this case is one brought by the minority shareholder seeking to be bought out for distribution of the value of shares within the estate, and that this is not a case involving wrongful conduct by a majority shareholder.
Wasn't this case originally filed as a dissolution, making those allegations, but then your client elected to buy the shares, which changed the issue to be squarely just fair value of those shares?
Correct. They brought these allegations of judicial dissolution, but as previously addressed during appellant's argument, they still put on evidence of shareholder oppression, right? They, in order to get the probable grounds of relief, that's still a relevant issue and one which they attempted to put on evidence of a trial. And the court specifically heard that evidence, made that finding that this is not a case of wrongful conduct by majority shareholders. As a result, it's not analogous to our dissenting shareholder appraisal rights cases. And so it would be inappropriate to apply discounts in this case. It's more akin to a case where you just have a minority shareholder who wishes to be bought out. And that's consistent with the lower court testimony where the personal representative acknowledged she would rather have the be bought out rather than it going to the six devisee sisters under the will and they each own a 2% interest.
Counsel, I want to be sure that we're on the same page. Would you agree with me that our Nebraska statute does not divert or go differently than the Model Act, at least in these sections that we're talking about?
Yes, I believe, to the best of my recollection, the wording and phrasing is the same. That 14.34, which is our judicial dissolution statute, that phrasing is the same as 14.34 of the Model Business Corporation Act. And likewise, our judicial appraisal statute is the same as that particular section of the Model Business Corporation Act.
If that's the case, and of course, fair value is a defined term in the appraisal rights section, it's not defined in the other section. Isn't it the most logical view of the Model Business Corporation Act that fair value term in the dissolution context was considered a term of art which had already been defined in the appraisal rights statute?
I would counter with that if the drafters of the Model Business Corporation Act and subsequently the Nebraska legislature wanted that definition to apply, there's two ways they could have accomplished that. They could have specifically made reference in 14.34 to incorporate that definition.
That would have been different from the Model Act, right?
Right, at the Nebraska. But the same, if the Model Business Corporation Act drafters intended for that same definition to apply, they could have incorporated it, or it could have been part of a general definitional provision rather than specific to just the judicial appraisal section. And I think that goes to the comments to the Act, which were referred to earlier. The 2013 comments to 14.34 speak to this specific issue, and it says, yes, absolutely, in some circumstances, it's going to make sense to pull in that definition, including the exclusion of discounts where there's evidence of shareholder oppression. However, in other circumstances where it's not, there hasn't been evidence of wrongful conduct, there hasn't been evidence of shareholder oppression, then it's not going to be appropriate to pull in those definitions. And that is why we don't have a definition in this section. We're giving the lower court flexibility to hear the evidence, weigh the credibility of the witnesses, and then make that assessment and determination. And that's exactly what the district court did in this case.
I beg your pardon. Yes. Is this correct that in your view, the irregularities that were identified by opposing counsel and the testimony at wherever it was, 75 plus, right, that's just out of the case in terms of relevance at this point?
It's still relevant because it goes to both my argument as it relates to whether or not discounts are appropriate and the court's finding that because there's not evidence of oppression, discounts are appropriately used. And it also goes to that expense issue. But I would disagree both with the characterization and appellate's brief and argument today that those purported concerns rise to the level of shareholder oppression. I think if you read the testimony, I just disagree with the characterization of what that evidence has been put on. I would also point to Mr. Chris Benish's testimony that rebutted a lot of that evidence. And ultimately the lower court heard that, reached her own determination based on what came in and the credibility of it. So I do believe it is relevant both to, if we're looking at whether or not discounts are applied, if we're looking at that oppression factor, it's relevant. And then it goes to the issue of probable grounds for relief.
You referred a moment ago to the 2013 version of the Model Business Corporation Act. When I was pulling up online, I found a 2016 version. Is there a substantial difference between those?
From my recollection, I believe the 2016 comments are pared down and they don't include that specific reference.
Okay. So to find the language that you were relying upon, I'd have to go back and look at 2013.
Yeah, it's specifically in the 2013 revision, and that's we quoted in our brief, but our citation also makes clear that comment comes from the 2013 revision. And I know for whatever reason it can be hard to actually access and find comments to the Model Business Corporation Act.
And help me a little bit here. My recollection vaguely is that the Model Business Corporation Act was initially adopted by the legislature with a future effective date, and then it was postponed for some period of time. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. But that's just going by my best recollection, so I can't commit to that. You can picture the statute and the and actually I have it printed, so maybe it'll tell us the.
And I'm looking at our statute. At least the last version of it is 2017. So by the time our legislature ultimately, at least in the appraisal rights, and I should look at the other statute too to see if it was, it's also 2017. So by that time, the 2016 Model Business Corporation Act was in existence and the comments presumably would have been available to the legislature.
Correct. Both versions of the comments would have been available to the legislature. But regardless of whether that was included or not in the comment, I think there's several cases that we cite in our brief that, support this flexible approach, which I think is in line with the fact that this, at the end of the day, there's an equitable nature of judicial dissolution proceedings. And by granting courts that flexibility in determining whether or not discounts are appropriate, based on the circumstances of the business, the circumstances of the party, that's really what's ultimately getting to true fair value. And really briefly, I see my time is up, but I did want to address, appellant asserted that the denial of discounts was the predominant and overwhelming theory, and he cites 8 cases in his reply brief, or the PR cites 8 cases in her reply brief. In review of those cases, 4 of them are appraisal rights dissenting shareholder cases, and 2 of the cases advocate what I'm advocating here today, a flexible approach that looks at whether there's shareholder oppression. And I would assert that the final 2 cases are distinguishable, but nonetheless, respectfully disagree that there's predominant and overwhelming theory in support of that. I see I'm out of time. If there's no other questions, I respectfully submit on the brief.
There any other questions? Appears not. Councilor, Mr. Bailiff, how long did we allow Appalee to go over? Very well. You have 57 seconds of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Honorable. Speak quickly. And the only thing I wanted to touch on, because it wasn't, I don't think, addressed as part of my primary argument, was the cross appeal. Because there is a cross appeal in this case based on the question of whether the income approach or the asset approach should be applied. We basically have three positions on that. One being that the court has the deference as listening to both of the experts in this case to determine who was the more compelling with respect to valuation. Our expert presented a valuation of an asset valuation as a going concern, not an asset valuation as in liquidation, which is the position that Ms. Levins, the opposing expert, took. I would also point out that neither of the experts actually presented the underlying court with a true income approach. My client the expert testified that they went through the process and determined it was going to be a negative value because we have massive assets, very little income. And their expert indicated at that time, I'm out of time. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. The cause is submitted and counsel are excused and the court is adjourned for the day. Thank you all very much. Thank you.